Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the new book, The Constitutional Foundations of Intellectual Property, A Natural Rights Perspective. We have on board the authors, Mr. Randolph J. May, he's president of the Free State Foundation, along with co-author Seth L. Cooper, who's a senior fellow, also with the Free State Foundation. We'll be hearing opening remarks from each of them in that order for about 10 to 12 minutes, and then comments from Professor Mark F. Schultz. He's a senior scholar and co-director of academic programs at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University School of Law, and he's an associate professor at Southern Illinois University School of Law. I mentioned the book, The Constitutional Foundations of Intellectual Property. It's available on North Carolina Academic Press, and it's available at Amazon, and presumably it's available in bookstores if you have a bookstore near you. I wanted to note that a lot of academic press, the prices are prohibitive, but this is a particularly attractively priced book. So check it out on Amazon or at North Carolina Academic Press. And please note, as always, that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of your question in the latter half of the program. With that, time to get started. Let me turn things over to Mr. May.
Well, Dean, thanks very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this call today. I appreciate it. I just want to note quickly at the beginning, it's actually Carolina Academic Press, which, believe it or not, is over in Durham, North Carolina, near my alma mater, Duke University. So if you're just trying to Google it, it's Carolina Academic Press, and that's at www.caplaw.com. And I also want to thank Mark Schultz for joining us. As many of you know, Mark is one of the most prominent and esteemed experts on intellectual property law in the country, so I appreciate Mark's being here as well. So first, I just want to say a quick word about why we decided to write the book. Both Seth and I, of course, are supportive of protecting property rights. Indeed, when I founded the Free State Foundation back in 2006, right at the top of the Free State Foundation's homepage, I identified supporting the protection of property rights is one of our chief objectives in conjunction with our overall mission to promote free market, limited government, and rule of law principles. Now, I think it goes without saying that in today's digital age, intellectual property contributes mightily and in growing proportions to the health of our nation's economy. Nevertheless, over the past number of years, it became increasingly clear to Seth and I that a large number of people, including some of those who proclaim themselves supporters of property rights or even constitutionalists, do not believe that intellectual property is property at all, and that others don't believe that anything that appears online, this is especially true of people younger than myself, many of those people don't believe that anything that appears online constitutes property that should be safeguarded. You probably all have heard the mantra, information wants to be free. Now, whether or not intellectual property rights, and I should say probably at the outset that our book is focused on copyright and patents, whether or not IP rights should be safeguarded can be discussed and debated in utilitarian terms, or perhaps in pragmatic terms, maybe in other ways. And these approaches certainly may have merit in addressing certain issues, especially what we may call boundary issues, such as the length of patent terms, for example, or the scope of the fair use doctrine. What our book seeks to do is not to deal with the boundary issues, but rather to recover the Constitution's understanding of IP rights is ultimately grounded in the natural rights of authors and inventors. To this end, the book explores the foundational concepts of property, including intellectual property, that inform the Constitution and it explains how these concepts continued to inform the development of IP rights right through the Constitutional Convention, through the First Congress, and right up to Reconstruction. So I want to spend just a minute or two discussing the 17th century English philosopher John Locke, who, as most of you know, was a significant influence on the thinking of our founders, especially with respect to their acceptance of natural rights principles that ultimately found clear expression in the Declaration of Independence, but also, important for our purposes here today, into the fabric of the Constitution. Now, as Locke explained in a famous passage in his landmark Second Treatise of Government, quote, "Every man has a property interest in his or her own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever then he removes out of the state of that nature hath provided and left it in, he hath mixed with his labor with and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property." So stated plainly, Locke understood that each person to possess a natural right to the fruits of his or her own labor that the civil society established by government is obligated to protect. In Lockean terms, as we say in the book, the product or expression of a person's creative activity or the resulting mixture of a person's labor with his or her resources to produce something to which he or she attaches value, that is each person's own property by right of original acquisition and first possession. We attempt to show in our book, and I think we succeed, that the founders in drafting the Constitution and specifically including the IP clause in it accepted John Locke's principle that one person cannot be deprived of the natural right to enjoy what he or she has earned by virtue of his or her own labor, and that this natural right necessarily includes the fruit of a person's intellectual labors, such as their writings or inventions. It is our contention that this natural rights perspective regarding the safeguarding of property was embodied in our Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, the Intellectual Property Clause, or the IP Clause, which grants Congress the power, quote, "to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for a limited time to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries." So in a moment, I'm going to stop and let Seth pick up the story in our book at this point and give you a sense of what we do in the remainder of the book to show how these constitutional foundations were laid. But I just want to, before I do that, we were honored, really, and pleased that we got a number of nice blurbs from some very prominent people concerning the book, and I just want to, if I can, read two of these quickly. And the first is from Paul Clement, who most of you know is a former Solicitor General of the United States. And Paul said, quote, "An essential volume for anyone who cares about the Constitution and intellectual property. The framers thought intellectual property was important enough to provide for its protection expressly in the Constitution. This book provides invaluable insights into the framers' decision and should inform contemporary debates about the nature of that protection," close quote. And then the other one is from Mary Beth Peters, who was Register of Copyrights of the United States from 1994 to 2011. And I should say I've never actually met Mary Beth Peters, but she was kind enough to get a copy of the book and read it and provide this blurb. And so Mary Beth Peters said, and by the way, these are on the Amazon site if you want to look at the others. Ms. Peters said, quote, "I love the book, and I hope it finds a large audience. Over the years, I've had many people tell me that my interpretation of the Constitution's intellectual property clause was wrong. Hopefully, this new book, with its scholarly yet highly readable treatment, will refocus the debate about IP rights on first principles and our founders' intentions, close quote. Now, before handing off to Seth, just one more plug, and that is that if we've enticed you today, or hopefully you haven't got your fill, next Monday at the National Press Club at 12 o'clock, that's October 26, we're doing a program where Seth and I are going to talk some more about the book, and we've got a couple panelists who are going to respond, including another register of the copyrights. So that's Monday at noon at the Press Club, and despite what you may have heard, I think I've said this many times myself, that there's no free lunch. The fact of the matter is, it is a free lunch next Monday at the Press Club. There's no charge. You just need to go to our website, www.freestatefoundation.org, and find the information and register, and we would love to have you there. So with that, Seth, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you, Randy, and thank you also to the Federalist Society. I've been involved with the Federalist Society going back to the days when I'm a student, so I'm delighted to be on this call, and I'm delighted to speak about our book, The Constitutional Foundations of Intellectual Property, and Natural Rights Perspectives. Our book examines the source and core concepts of copyrights and patent rights in the American constitutional order. And in the book, we trace the development of the Constitution's logic of intellectual property rights through roughly the first century of the nation's history. The text of the IP clause that Randy quoted earlier is short and simple, so grasping the Constitution's ideological context is important to understanding the Constitution's text. And in early America, that was all really a matter of common sense and a matter of justice, the things that Randy went over from Locke. And really the finest succinct statement of a person's rights and property from this period in America was by James Madison in his 1792 National Gazette essay on property. I won't quote from it here, but I would recommend anyone read it. We resort to it frequently throughout the book. It's widely available on the internet, and it's a pretty short read. In any event, early on in our nation's history, those basic ideas about property rights, those classic liberal ideas about a person's right and property, were directly applied to creative works and inventions. In the years prior to the Constitution, copyrights and patent rights were regarded as unique forms of property rights that are rooted in a person's natural rights to keep what they earn, to reap what they've sown. And in the 1780s, the Confederation Congress passed a resolution calling on states to adopt copyright laws. Within a few years of the resolution, every state's legislature but one adopted their own copyright laws, and several states also adopted patent laws. And a number of those state laws, if you look at them, they characterize copyrights or patents as property rights that are rooted in a person's natural rights. So, for example, the preamble to the Connecticut 1783 copyright law declares it is perfectly agreeable to the principles of natural equity and justice that every author should be secured in receiving the profits that may arise from the sale of his works. And Massachusetts copyright law from the same year described the legal security of the fruits of author, study, and industry as one of the natural rights of all men, there being no property more peculiarly a man's own than that which is produced by the labor of his mind. It's interesting that several of the state legislatures, and we go into this in our book, were personally lobbied on copyright as well by Noah Webster. And Webster petitioned, wrote letters, he spoke personally with legislators in several states as part of his book tour for the American Speller. And he consistently made the case for copyright as literary property, as it was often termed, based on an author's inherent right to receive the financial rewards for their mind's labor. And certainly not to be forgotten, Webster worked closely with James Madison in securing copyright protection for authors. And there was an important copyright alliance between Webster, the father of copyright, and Madison, the father of copyright. Our book has a lot more to say on that, and I think that would appeal to readers who are interested in what the Founding Fathers did and said on these issues, and that really provides a nice gateway for people who maybe don't have a broad background in intellectual property rights to be introduced to these subjects by sort of considering what did the Founders do. And again, in the early American context, those Lockean underpinnings about property and a person's labor were affirmed and applied directly to intellectual property. That was the commonplace view when the Constitution was drafted and ratified. And so it was really unnecessary for the IP clause to expound on theories of rights of labor or the theoretical underpinnings of property. In truth, the IP clause realized the natural rights of authors and inventors, and it certainly didn't reject them. And the IP clause's language about promoting progress of science and useful arts is certainly meant to guide Congress in judiciously deciding the length of terms of copyright and patent protection, and that makes good sense. Certainly the Constitution is a practical super legal framework for organizing and allocating the powers. The IP clause simply sets forth Congress's delegated authority. But for purposes of constitutional understanding, really the ultimate source of IP rights remains in the labor of authors and inventors. That's a given of the Constitution. And Randy and I believe that this source of intellectual property rights and a person's intellectual labors should lead everyone, including and especially Congress, to take intellectual property rights seriously. These intellectual property rights, they're not artificial contrivances or special privileges of government. The government should not be free to hand out or abolish them on a whim. Our book really challenges the drive-by claim that's often made that copyrights and patents or intellectual property rights are just forms of government monopoly. As we show, we really put them in the context of property rights. That's something quite different, and that was the view expressed by the likes of Madison and the likes of Webster and others. And as we go on to explain in the book, the first Congress certainly took its duty under the IP clause seriously. The first Congress passed the first Copyright and Patent Acts in 1790, and as most people know, many members of that Congress were delegates to the Philadelphia Convention or its state ratifying conventions, and some both. And in fact, President George Washington signed both laws. So from there, after the first Congress, our book traces the development of IP rights concepts up to the nation's centennial in 1876. And along the way, our book ties together the insights of James Kent, Joseph Story, Daniel Webster, and Abraham Lincoln. And what's interesting is we see those constitutional thinkers and statesmen voicing and acting on shared basic notions of copyrights and patents as property rooted in a person's natural rights to the fruits of their labor and deserving protection under the Constitution. And so our book kind of leaves off with one of the main pillars there is Abraham Lincoln, who expressed support for intellectual property, certainly as in his lead up to his time as president in the 1850s, he gave a series of lectures on discoveries and inventions, and in his address to the Wisconsin Agricultural Society is very interesting, in which he describes intellectual property and patents in particular within the context of free labor ideology, which is just really just sort of a variation of the same basic ideas that John Locke advanced and that Randy discussed earlier. So that's where we go in the book. I hope readers will find it interesting. Again, we just sort of put this subject, intellectual property rights, in the American constitutional context. And we really just sort of strung a lot of these thinkers together and found a remarkable logical consistency in how they understood copyrights and patents as constitutionally protected property rights.
Mark, you want to pick up there, Mark, and then I'll just follow you.
Yes, thank you, Randy and Seth, and thanks for the chance to comment on this book. I really appreciated the book in its development, as Randy and Seth released a series of essays, and I was really pleased to see the book come out as a whole. It's really an important contribution. First and foremost to me, the book is a welcome correction to a view of intellectual property that's been embraced in conventional wisdom, particularly, unfortunately, in academia, legal academia, the last 20 years. It's a view that's far too reductionist, in my view. And here's what the view is. It's really common to say that intellectual property is justified only on utilitarian grounds. Scholars look to the constitutional language that says that these rights, this power is granted to Congress in order to promote the progress of science and useful arts. And they conclude that the founders were thus embracing a kind of utilitarianism that's really anachronistic, although Jeremy Bentham was writing at the time of the founding, and the founders were certainly aware of his work. It was hardly influential. It was a much different tradition the founders came from, the tradition that Randy and Seth discuss in their book. But this utilitarian view contends that intellectual property rights are essentially an embarrassment, a monopoly granted to creators and inventors to induce them to create more of what the public wants and needs. And they're only justified in as much as they secure for the public more stuff. And in this view, we see the inventor or creator is portrayed essentially as a rat on a wheel, and the intellectual property right is the cheese we hold out, and we regretfully have to hold out some cheese to the rat, but we hold out as little as possible because the ultimate point is to benefit the public, and creators and inventors are just means to other people's ends. And this, as a matter of description, not to mention philosophy and history, this is a really impoverished view of intellectual property rights and their justification. And the way I see Randy and Seth's book is part of a broader intellectual project to reconnect intellectual property to a natural rights foundation rooted in Lockean labor theory. And the book's major contribution is to connect this intellectual history and this philosophical justification to the founders' era and the reasons the founders included intellectual property in our Constitution and how this natural rights view was reflected in the jurisprudence of our early republic. And I think the book is very well done that way, in that respect, and it's an important contribution. Now, let me provide some of that broader intellectual context, this context of this broader intellectual project to reconnect intellectual property to a natural rights foundation, because I think it answers some of the likely objections that they're often raised to the natural rights view. The Lockean labor view is often, I think, misunderstood and overly simplified. And I think that we've seen several scholars in recent years attempt to rehabilitate Lockean labor theory, particularly in the realm of intellectual property, but even before that, to try to help people understand what is meant by labor and value in the context of Lockean labor theory. But some of the scholars whose work I would cite in this regard, who are doing a really important work regrounding intellectual property in its natural rights foundation, include my colleagues Adam Mossoff and Eric Claes at George Mason, as well as the leading intellectual property scholar Robert Merges and philosophers such as Adam Moore and Kenneth Einar-Himmer. The key move here is to understand labor as productive labor. Now, labor isn't just aimless wandering or accidental movements of one's hand or unproductive doodlings. As the philosopher A. John Simmons describes this relationship, labor means free, intentional, purposive action aimed at satisfying needs or supplying conveniences of life. Now, that's rather philosophically stated, and Robert Merges puts it a little more bluntly. Labor is that which one does to survive, is purposive action aimed at surviving and thriving. And in this view, labor is grounded in human flourishing. And this is an important move to understanding the how intellectual property and property generally can be grounded in Lockean labor theory. Because when we understand labor in this manner, labor generates both important and justifiable activity, intelligent, purposeful activity that promotes one's own surviving and thriving, and a right to engage in such activity, but it's conditioned. It's conditioned on the laborer respecting others' reciprocal rights to labor in like fashion. So, look, the individual, creator or inventor, or anyone who's creating property in the world or performing intellectual labor, has a right and a need to survive and thrive, to flourish in the world, but their rights are limited by the needs of others to survive and thrive. And indeed, their rights are justified and shaped by their contribution they make to human flourishing. So when we look at patents and we look at copyrights, we grant them for good reasons and the right way. And the way in which we and how we justify them for good reason to grant a patent or a copyright is they must contribute something to human flourishing. In the case of patents, something a truly new, novel, and non-obvious invention, something new in the world, not just something that already existed that the government arbitrarily grants a monopoly over, but something truly new that contributes to the flourishing of others and in turn as a property right helps secure the survival and thriving of the inventor. Similarly with copyright, the creator contributes original expression, their own unique point of view that in some way edifies or educates or entertains others. They've contributed something to the world. We protect their rights and the rights of others. And the utilitarian critique often is concerned that intellectual property rights have to be balanced. And this is where we find the balance with respect to the natural rights view, this balance in a focus on human flourishing. Productive labor, which justifies property rights, must contribute to the betterment of the individual, their surviving and their thriving, as well as human flourishing generally. And this is where we find the balance. Now, utilitarians look to a false sense of false empiricism and claim that somehow we must determine the proper input of intellectual property rights to secure a particular output of social utility as if they could measure social utility with any real accuracy or certainty. Natural rights theory looks to political actors to design institutions that consider the due needs of both the creators of property as well as the public, and thus, you know, looks to human flourishing as a measure of the justification and a way to design particular institutions. The way we design novelty in patent law or originality in copyright law. And this, I think, and even this view of the need to justify intellectual property in terms of human flourishing, in terms of both the creator's needs and the needs of others, helps to explain why a property right justified on natural rights grounds could be limited in time, because at some point it becomes more important for others' labors, others' due needs to labor and flourish, to be able to use that intellectual creation freely. And this is what justifies limited terms. It's something that often puzzles people. Shouldn't, if property rights are justified on a natural rights basis, shouldn't they last forever? And not necessarily so. And so we can morally justify intellectual property rights based on Lockean labor theory. And in doing so, we can create intellectual property institutions that I think fulfill Madison's prediction. You know, as Madison argued, in one of the few statements that were made, that the founders made with the framers made with respect to intellectual property, he said in Federalist Paper 43 that the public good fully coincides in both cases with the claims of individuals. See, the public is more likely to get the works that educate, edify, entertain, and inform them if their creators can obtain just compensation. So at the heart of intellectual property, the interest of IP owners and the public need no balancing or reconciliation. And this is really the genius of the American political and economic system, is that it's shown time and time again that allowing free people to reap the rewards of their labor benefits both the individual and society in great and equal measures. And so in this way, the public interest is best served when individuals and entrepreneurs are empowered and free, and property rights of all kinds are essential to such full and free lives. So like other property rights, intellectual property rights are essential to individual liberty and essential to the free market system that drives our economy. I think this broader intellectual project that's being advanced by scholars who candidly far exceed my powers of erudition and analysis is helping to reground intellectual property in its historical natural rights foundation. This utilitarian justification was really a project of the progressives and a 20th century view of IP. It's not a historic or traditional view of IP by any means. And so I really appreciate Randy and Seth's book for contributing to this intellectual project. So thanks for a great book, and thanks for your great work.
I want to, Randy, before I turn back to you and Seth, let me open the floor to questions and just people can begin queuing up before I give you guys an opportunity to revise and extend. So in a moment, we'll hear an announcement that the floor mode is on. When you hear that, push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. I'm sure Mark Schultz will take your questions, but so too will the authors of the book. Of course, we're discussing the Constitutional Foundations of Intellectual Property, A Natural Rights Perspective. That's the title of the book, and it's available on Amazon.com, but also at Carolina Academic Press. Let's hear this announcement now. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller with a question, but I think, Randy May, you were going to say something let me just ask you to repeat your website as well and ask if people need to register for the event, which I think you said is a Monday at noon at the Press Club.
Yeah, it's Monday at noon at the Press Club, and the website is www.freestatefoundation.org. Just look for information about that event and the book, and please register and join us. It's aside from the nice lunch, we're going to have an interesting discussion, I'm sure. So, Dean, let me just take a second, and then we'll go to questions or take a minute. One thing I wanted to say, when Seth was talking about the alliance between Noah Webster and James Madison, I think in haste he referred to both of those gentlemen as father of copyrights, and of course Madison is referred to as the father of the Constitution. But I bring that up just because I think there's quite a bit of information about Noah Webster and his efforts to promote copyright even before the adoption of the Constitution, and in doing that, his invocation of the natural rights theory to reward one's own labor, that Marx spoke so well about, and our book speaks to. There's a lot of information in there about Webster that most people, I'm quite sure, are not familiar with. And the same would go for Abraham Lincoln and the information about his interest in intellectual property. And we've got a whole chapter in the book, for example, on the development of these concepts that we talk about during the antebellum era after the founders had departed from this scene and up to the Civil War, where we discuss contributions from Justice Story and Chancellor Kent and Daniel Webster and so forth. So I say that by way of saying that there's this book is not a it's not a case book, and we think it's quite scholarly, but you know, I think if you're just interested in history and biography, as backdrops for the discussion about property and intellectual property, I'm quite confident you'll find it interesting. And I'll just add, there's to my way of thinking, the bibliography that's at the end of the book, it runs on for about 15 pages or so. I think for anyone that has an interest in intellectual property, the founders, constitutional history, I think just the bibliography, I think you'll find that's worth the price of the book. So with that, we ought to turn to the questions. But again, so I don't forget, I want to thank Mark and his fellows and colleagues over at the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property are doing obviously important work that Seth and I rely on as well. So, Dean, let me hand it back to you with that.
Terrific. We've got three questions pending. We've got about almost 20 minutes, so let's start with our first question of the day.
Hello. My name is Raymond Van Dyke. I'm an intellectual property patent practitioner, but I also teach. Part of what I'm teaching is the history of IP, so I'm very interested in your book. One question I had, I missed the first 10 minutes, but Thomas Jefferson, some of his later in life comments, as well as Benjamin Franklin, that were sort of anti-patent. Does your book address those types of issues?
It does. This is Randy, and that's a great question, and one, you know, we've of course felt like we should deal with. We have really a chapter in the book on that reconciles, in our view, Jefferson's views and some of the statements, some of which we think, you know, it or might be out of context, or if put in proper context would be understood differently. But reconciling that view, Seth, I'm going to let you say just a word about that. To answer the question, but not so much that the gentleman won't want to buy the book and read about it all.
Yes, this is Seth Cooper. We have a chapter devoted to Jefferson, and Jefferson's such a fascinating figure that it was fun to put in there. He does write some letters both later in his life and earlier in his life, while the Constitutional Convention was taking place, in which he does make some assertions about intellectual property, or to be honest, I think they're a little half-baked, but he does make them, and we just sort of point out some of the context to that. Jefferson, of course, was in Paris when the Constitutional Convention was going on, so we just kind of place in the context of how much influence did his letters have, what was he really saying. You do see him become somewhat reconciled through later letters while he was in Paris, and at other times, not so critical after all. And certainly he was the one who came in and served as Secretary of State and administering the patent system right away, and had some role as well, certainly as a president and as an administrator. And so our book chapter also sort of analyzes Jefferson the administrator and how how intellectual property fared under his watch. And so, based on his record as an administrator, he certainly had a critique of the early patent system of the Patent Act of 1790, but sought ways to improve it and make the administration more efficient. So we do that, and, we kind of make our own arguments of just how one could simply accept a lot of Jefferson's basic philosophical principles, like, such as he laid out in the Declaration of Independence, and still find justification for intellectual property rights, even if perhaps Jefferson, through some idiosyncrasies, didn't. We think it's certainly a case on Jeffersonian principles, even if not made by Jefferson the man, could be made. And I think it's an interesting chapter, and it was fun to address.
And I suppose I would be remiss here if I didn't refer to my my good friend and colleague Adam Mossoff's Law Review article entitled "Who Cares What Thomas Jefferson Thought About Patents: Reevaluating the Patent Privilege in Historical Context." As Professor Mossoff explains in that article, that you know that particular quote, in particular, is a letter that Jefferson wrote to Isaac McPherson that's often misused to claim it probably represents what the founders thought. As Seth said, that really wouldn't be the case, especially not what the framers thought. And more generally, the intellectual history of IP in the early Republic shows that instead that patents were civil rights securing important property rights, and very much influenced by natural rights theory. So, and other scholars such as Justin Hughes have argued that Jefferson, you know, said many things over the course of his lifetime, and that, as Seth says, if you look at his writings and understand the intellectual context overall, that Jefferson isn't the enemy of intellectual property, as he is portrayed mostly based on the McPherson letter. So I think those are important things to note. Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just two questions pending, then our lines are open. Take another call.
So this is David Warder, USPTO. From the debates to write the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, there doesn't seem to be much talk or debate on intellectual property. It seems that these issues were pretty much just assumed by the framers that this concept would be in place. What was the immediate context that they were working with in British law at the time? Was this just a very wide consensus in the legal community that patents and copyrights were accepted and good, or was there a controversy in this area at the time of the writing of the Constitution?
Yes, this is Seth Cooper. We address these kinds of questions mm-hmm. in Chapter 5 of our book, some of the ratification period, and we deal with Federalist Paper number 43 that Mark mm-hmm. was discussing earlier. I think you're right in your question or the premise of it, that there wasn't a lot of discussion about it, and a lot of things were taken as a given. And I think that the intellectual context that Randy set out at the beginning was part of the given, and what Mark just said about intellectual property being regarded as, you know, civil right protecting property rights was a given. So there were other issues that were more in the front burner, obviously, that took people's time up. But we do sort of go at some length in Chapter 5 to sort of unfold the logic and some of the terms of art of Madison's discussion of copyrights and patents in Federalist 43. And when you do that and sort of make a principled sort of historical case, there was quite a bit to say. The issue of British law or British common law, the legal backdrop for copyrights and patents, there was some uncertainty at this time. And that was one of the reasons, of course, why state copyright laws were necessary before the Constitution. That was one of the reasons why the Intellectual Property Clause was adopted. The general rule was that British common law, the decisions of courts in Britain, did not apply in America unless there was some clear and express kind of statement, or at least the statute of Parliament. Excuse me, not necessarily the common law. The statutes of Parliament, and so the statute of Anne was the British sort of deal on that. So Madison kind of grapples with that, and we kind of grapple with that in the book. There was some ambiguity and uncertainty. I'll just put it that way. And that was one of the reasons why we got the intellectual property clause.
This is Randy. I mean, just to add to that or reemphasize, I guess, the point that I talked about at the beginning, it's widely acknowledged, I think, I don't believe there's much contradiction about this, that John Locke and his writings were very influential, and that the founders were very familiar with them, and Locke's discussion about government's role in protecting property, life, liberty, and property, I think was accepted by the founders, and the Declaration, of course, speaks of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which I think, in terms of the labor theory that we've discussed, is another way of saying that. And so, you know, I think that's a foundational starting point, I think, for putting the constitutional convention and why we ended up with the IP clause in context, although it's true, as we've said, there, this was not one of the provisions that was debated like the New Jersey Compromise or slavery or so forth.
Yeah, this is Seth again. I'll just say quickly, you know, Sir William Blackstone regarded intellectual property as rooted in natural rights. Lord Mansfield felt the same way. The debate in England at the time was whether or not you needed a statute of parliament to recognize copyrights or patents or not. And so there was confusion about that, and there was confusion then about the application of that in the New World. And that was the context in which Madison wrote Federalist 43.
Thank you.
Professor Schultz, did you have anything on this point?
No, my colleagues answered it ably.
Okay. Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got this one question, and then our lines are wide open. Let's take our next caller.
Hi, this is Christian Stau from the International Center for Law and Economics. I'll start by saying I began reading the book yesterday. I've only gotten through the first couple of chapters, so maybe my question time, but it seemed timely to bring it up now. Following from the first question, and I say this as a devoted Jeffersonian, Thomas Jefferson said a lot of things, and he had a lot of self-contradiction in a lot of things he said, which kind of gets to my hesitation when I approached your book on referring to the founder's thoughts on whether this is a natural right or not, because to me that strikes as an appeal to authority, and I want to know why right now, what the utility of thinking about IP rights as natural rights are, because consequentialism does get us quite a lot. So, you know, for instance, government doesn't necessarily protect all natural rights. I would try to at least make the argument that, for instance, economic rights are some form of natural right, and as we all are familiar, government does not really care as much about them as it should. So the force of the state is employed or not employed through a social agreement. So to some extent, whether or not IP rights are natural rights, the use of those rights and the utility of those rights is going to be defined by some sort of social agreement, which makes them, in essence, a kind of a hybrid. There is a positive aspect, even if there is a natural rights aspect underlying it. So my question is, what is it that thinking about IP rights as natural rights actually nets us, when the real question is what the enforcement is, and that enforcement is going to be a social compact question. And then following on from that, what is it about it being a natural right that defines what the extent of enforcement should be? Obviously, there's going to be limits. There's limits on all forms of property. Why are, for instance, the time limits we have now good or bad, and what should they be as dictated by the natural rights basis of IP rights?
Well, this is Randy. Let me start off, and I wouldn't be surprised if Mark or Seth, you know, wants to add more, but just we don't have a lot of time. So you know, quickly, I'm not sure whether you were on the beginning of the call, Christian, but you know, I would say part of what motivated us to write the book really was what seems to be a fairly significant segment of the population that just doesn't appreciate and understand intellectual property rights, and we don't maintain that. I think I said at the beginning that we understand their issues, like the ones that you, I think, mentioned concerning the length of terms or scope of the fair use doctrine or others that are not answered, or you know, the natural rights approach doesn't tell you how long a copyright term should be, but a utilitarian approach might be helpful in arriving at the right answer. And I think Mark talked about that, but I think what is important is that to the extent that the natural rights philosophy, that natural rights principles influenced our founders for the reasons we talked about, and Locke and so forth, and that became part of the constitutional context, really, in our understanding of the Constitution, then it's important not to be dismissive about that, because at bottom, the principle ought to be pretty paramount in our in our American system of government, I think, and maybe Mark referred to it that way, and that is that if you create something by your own labor, that you have a property interest in that. And one of the most important functions of government is to protect property, life, liberty, and property. And, and that's a pretty foundational principle, it's important not to forego that principle. And then you can dispute whether a copyright term ought to be X number of years or Y number of years or so forth. So that's the way I would respond to you.
We do have one more question.
Is there time to say a word or two here?
Go right ahead. We've got almost 10 minutes left, so go right ahead, Mark.
So yeah, there's a question. What does Natural Rights Foundation get us that the Utilitarian Foundation doesn't? There's a couple things wrapped up in there. One is that utilitarianism overclaims. It claims to a precision and an ability to measure that it's just not up to. It's also doesn't do a terribly good job of explaining a lot of the doctrines we have in intellectual property law. It doesn't tell you a lot about originality or in copyright or other doctrines. And I was at a conference on Friday, and one professor kept lamenting during question and answer period that our practice doesn't fit our utilitarian theory, so we need to change our practice. And I said to him, maybe your theory is wrong. And I think that's the question, is what foundation better suits the development, historical development of the doctrines we have in IP law? What foundation better explains why we do what we do in IP law? And natural rights, a labor theory, can get us a lot of the way there. Here's a point. Another point I'll make. You said, the questioner said something that a lot of folks do, which is they equate utilitarian with consequentialism, It's only one form of consequentialism. We can look to natural rights theory for a measure of what how institutions should be designed, and that measure is whether they promote human flourishing. We can look to the consequence, do they promote the creator's ability to survive and thrive with due regard to the others, ability of others to survive and thrive, and we allow political actors to create institutions that can be measured by that moral right, those moral rights, and we can be honest about what those political actors are doing. That they're doing something that's imprecise and that requires judgment,
and some degree of subjectivity. And utilitarians blanch at that because they believe that somehow they can more precisely measure social welfare. But I think that's a mirage. And a natural rights justification is far more in keeping with the historical foundations of property rights in America, and can, doesn't have to, but it can provide a strong foundation for property rights, including an intellectual property rights system. So I'll hand this back over to Dean.
Thank you very much. We do have one question pending. We've got about 5 minutes left, so let's see if we can get through this final question.
So thanks. This is Jeff Bergman, attorney in private practice. So I think this actually plays off the prior question a little bit. And I wonder, thinking through all this, you know, what is it about IP, either historically or philosophically or both, that leaves it more exposed to these kinds of disputes and kind of fundamental disputes? You know, thinking in comparison to, say, real property law, land law. I mean, we have constitutional debates all the time about what the proper extent of you know, property protection should be for an owner of real estate, but nobody realistically ever asserts that there is no such thing as a you know, right to, you know, an owner's right to ownership of land. Or, you know, we don't see the same kind of fundamental debates over whether the right even exists. And, you know, so what is it about IP that's so different that we've been having these discussions, you know, for hundreds of years, and there's no resolution in sight?
Seth, do you want to answer that?
Well, I think the answer is partly in the premise of the question. I think part of that is owed simply to the differences between tangible and intangible property, between physical and non-physical. Just the difficulty there can be, you know, when state of the art and technology changes and digitization and rapid communications comes into play, enforcing these things takes some additional work. Even it can bring additional benefits, of course, having these kinds of rights and property, and that's one of the reasons we wrote this book, The Benefits to Human Flourishing. I think those reasons relate to it. I mean, America certainly has a strong, when it comes to copyright, a strong freedom of speech tradition as well. So, you know, that's why we have a fair use doctrine, which we just touch on a little bit in this book as well. And so I think those things all go into sort of this sort of ongoing debate that you just discussed.
Well, and certainly to the extent that we're talking about intellectual property that gets on online, which of course is a heck of a lot of it these days, there's a, you know, and I can't explain it all, and we don't certainly don't justify it, but rather try and explain why it's the wrong mindset. But the whole notion that if you know, information gets online, whether it's protected or not, that the way you think about it should be you know, different from a property interest is, you know, appeals to a lot of people. But you know, in our minds, that's not a distinction that I mean, it has to do with how you enforce it and things like that. But it doesn't go to the nature of the property interest that ought to be protected, however difficult the challenges might be.
And I guess I'll also conclude by noting, I think appropriately for a Federalist Society teleconference, that perhaps unfortunately, in many of our views, that the strength of property rights, the extent of property rights, the amount of freedom and control one has with respect to property rights has hardly been uncontroversial in for many, many, many decades in this country. And so while people may not make the move of arguing, like Proudhon once did, that property is theft, they certainly want to block it and reduce it and curtail all of the things that the institution should mean and entail, which is a domain of freedom over a particular asset to do what you see fit as you need, bounded by the rights of others. And
And in that sense, the debate on intellectual property, I think, often reflects debates in the wider world as to the power of regulators. And often that's what it comes down to when you leave the philosophical realm and look at what arguments people are making about patents or copyrights. There's a desire to turn them into regulatory fiats that that are much more subject to government oversight. For example, the ability of a company with a standard essential patent to charge the license fee they see fit is being greatly curtailed today by FTC and DOJ oversight. And so, that's not so different from what we see with other regulatory actions with respect to real property or water rights or other property rights. So I think it is all in a keeping. You're right that people are more likely to directly attack the validity of IP rights as property rights, but in the trenches, I think the arguments for regulating property rights are essentially the same.
Well, gentlemen, we are out of time. We're on our out of our budgeted time. I want to thank, on behalf of the Federal Society, all of our experts, Professor Schultz, Randy May, Seth Cooper. The book, once again, is The Constitutional Foundations of Intellectual Property and Natural Rights Perspective. The website, freestatefoundation.org. The event that Randy May was talking about is Monday at noon at the Press Club. You can check it out on his website. Our next Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 1 o'clock when we'll be talking about, relatedly somewhat, the Redskins trademark case. That's tomorrow at 1 o'clock. But until that next Teleform call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.